I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and you're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest today is novelist Jacqueline Michard, the author of 13 novels and a number of books for young adults. Her most recent is The Good Son. We talked about balancing narrative with scene, creating sympathetic characters, writing the midpoint, and so much more. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. It's so nice to talk with you, Jacqueline, about The Good Son. I was immediately taken with the beginning. I thought, you know, with my students, I'm often speaking about first sentences, and the first sentence of The Good Son was tremendous and pulled me right into the book. And before we start, you know, kind of talking about process and writing, talk about how you came up with the idea for The Good Son.
Well, it was given to me, actually, by a woman who I was at a writer's conference where I was going to give a speech, and it was at a big hotel in Chicago, and I was in the line to get coffee before my address to the gathered writers. And there were a huge number of writers there, and there was a woman in front of me, and she dropped her book, and I picked the book up to give back to her. And I asked her if she was there for the writer's conference. And she said, no, she was there to visit her son who was in prison nearby. And right away I thought, oh, don't tell me why. Don't tell me what for. But she did tell me. And she said that he was in prison and would be for a long time because at the age of 19, he had killed his beloved girlfriend, the only girl he ever loved. And he had no memory at all of the crime because he was so messed up on methamphetamines. And how could I turn away from her? You know, I sat with her and talked to her, or let her talk to me. And she told me that one time she went to visit the grave of the girl and to put roses on the grave. And the girl's mother showed up, and they had at one time been friends. They'd known each other for most of their adult lives. And she thought, what's going to happen? You know, will she hit me? You know, will she scream? And instead the two mothers just held each other and cried. Mm. And the mother of the girl said, you're luckier because at least you can touch him. You can hug him. Mm. And those two scenes in a sense are in The Good Son, though everything else is different. You would never know. I mean, you would know that she would know if I even knew who she was, or if she ever picked it up, she would know that it was inspired by this. When I told my agent that I wanted to write a book about this, he said, well, that's all well and good, but you could never make any of those people sympathetic.
Hmm.
And I said, I can, I know I can. And he admits now that he was wrong. But I wanted to portray that impossible choice that the mother of the young man coming out of prison has about needing to help her son re-enter his life or try to rebuild his life somehow, even with the knowledge of what he's done.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So how long before you started the book was that interaction with the woman?
Oh, it was years. It was probably 5 or 6 years before I ever started the book. I had finished the book. The last book I wrote was published a few years ago. And I tried starting two other books. And unprecedented in my life as a writer, I could not get traction on either of those stories. And I've never had that happen to me. It shook my confidence. I thought I was gone. I thought that I was completely washed up. But I ended up going back to this idea. The talking to that woman had always haunted me. And then I had to convince my agent. And then I had to convince a publisher, because it was a new publisher, that this was an idea that would not be just a vicious downer.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. There seems to be various stories or series or movies that are kind of focused around prisons and prisoners lately, which I find really interesting that your book, you know, does the same thing. You know, it's just kind of the zeitgeist. I don't know. It's kind of, do you see that?
Well, I was just writing about it today, as a matter of fact, because one, I guess it must be in the ether, because one of the venues that I'm going to be speaking at later on in the year had asked me to write a blog post about, did I know anyone in those circumstances? Had I ever met anyone who was in prison, especially who was in prison after having been, if you will, living an ordinary middle-class life, if you will, like Stefan did. It did not seem that him serving time for something was part of his inevitable life path.
Right.
And the person who asked me to write the post suggested that I talk about whether it would be more or less difficult for an individual like that to survive emotionally in prison. I have no idea. Okay. Right. But I do know that when I talk to people who have served time, whether or not they come from a rough background or whether they come from a background that was not pointed in that direction by any stretch of the imagination, it's a terribly unnerving experience, because what you're robbed of in prison is not just your freedom, it's your privacy and your dignity and your ability to sort of walk in the world with a certain confidence and lack of fear. Because in prison, you're always afraid,
right?
Day and night, something could happen to you and it could have lifelong consequences or life-ending consequences. And even going to visit someone in prison, which I've done a few times in my life as a reporter and then as a novel writer as well, it's harrowing. I mean, hearing that door shut behind you, mm-hmm. even if you haven't done anything wrong and you know you can leave later, it is just unsettling, deeply unsettling. Mm.
I've had a pen pal, a guy in a Midwestern prison for almost 10 years, I want to say. Oh. And I mean, not letters every month, but every other month, maybe I write to him. And it's just kind of an interesting experience, you know, just hearing what he's dealing with things he can't have, or, you know, he needs to buy paper, but, you know, he's running out of paper and there's no paper to buy. And I mean, it's crazy. And we think, you know, of freedom and how, you know, how long does somebody need to be there to pay back, you know, whatever they did. And
whatever, yes, whatever that happens to be.
Yeah, whatever it happens to be. It's really kind of an interesting, you know, experience to, you know, when I'm feeling like, you know, kind of whiny, and then I get a letter and he's so upbeat and is just, you know, just grateful for whatever he has. And I'm thinking, you know, I think I need to change my way of thinking about what I'm grateful for or something. You know, it's just an interesting contrast.
It's true that we take an enormous amount of autonomy in our lives for granted because, you know, culturally, if you will, and simply because we're not incarcerated, but also we live more or less in a place where where you can do what you please in a general way, unless you're harming somebody. And that isn't true for everybody in the world. And it certainly isn't true for anybody who's who's incarcerated, whatever level the crime is. And for this fictional character, he was particularly at a deficit in that he was so young. When you're young, you know, by virtue of nothing else except your youth, you're more vulnerable, but also because the crime of which he was convicted was against a woman.
Yes.
And that's a big deal.
So let's talk about the book on a sort of a, I don't know, more close up in terms of, so you had the idea, you had this interaction with the woman years ago, you had the idea, you start writing the book. How much did you need to know before you could write? I mean, are you an outliner? Did you need to know where you were headed? Did you have the ending? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, I'm most definitely an outliner. I could not ever write a book without knowing no more than I could go to the airport and say, here, I'll just have a ticket. You know, I have to know that when I get on that plane, I'm going to Minneapolis or wherever it is, and how I'm going there and how long it will take in a general way. And I also, sometimes I advise when I teach writing, when I teach graduate students who are involved with creative writing, I sometimes suggest that the best way to start a story or a novel is to write the last sentence. Mm-hmm. Because then you will progress, you'll work your way toward that ending if you know what the outcome is meant to be. Because entering a story is really difficult. I mean, I sweat those first sentences, and that particular one, the one that you just referred to in The Good Son, mm-hmm. I circled that probably for a number of weeks. And the way I am, my particular madness runs is that I don't allow myself to go on to any other part of the book until I have the first sentence, then the first page, then the first paragraph, the first chapter. I write it in succession in the way that I imagine you would build a house. First putting down the foundation and then the walls and then the windows and finally the roof. And I guess I don't feel comfortable going forward until I think what I've already done is as good as I can make it. And then of course, when it comes to when my agent sees it, he has like 42 changes that he wants, including why is that character in there? I don't even think he's necessary. And then when the editor gets to it, whoever he or she is has another bunch of changes. I don't see why he does this at this point. And here I was thinking it was just all swell, you know?
So what do you do with those changes or those suggestions for change? I mean, are they, you know, do you pick your battles? Do you, how do you deal with that?
Well, in my experience, and it is long experience, I've done this for a long time, they're generally right. And I generally make the changes. And that, I guess, is something that comes with being a professional at this, is you start to recognize that your agent and your editor are standing in for the eyes of your reader. Mm-hmm. And you can tell, you have an instinct as a writer for whether what that person is saying is valid and based on your welfare, or if it is based on the way that that person feels about it. Only once in all the books that I've written have I ever had a situation which I knew that the editor was really out, needed medicine and was out of his, he had gotten out and was running amok. And so it turned out to be, he started substituting other characters and rewriting whole chapters of the book and so forth, and was just out of control. But that had to do with with his needs and not the book. But in a general way, I take to my bed, you see, and cover up and cry. And then I get up and do what needs to be done and march right through those changes and try as best as I can to make all of them in a way that preserves my integrity, but also satisfies the people who are going to publish it.
Right. What about the midpoint of the book? Because I always seem to look for the midpoint to see if the change is there, or if the switch in direction, or the I don't know, illumination of the ending, or the suggestion of the ending is coming, and it is there in your book. And are you thinking that way? Are you thinking this has to happen at the midpoint of my book?
It sort of naturally occurs at the midpoint of anything. If you think of telling a story, you think of a fairy tale, mm-hmm. like you think of Cinderella, okay, something like that. And the ball, you know, going to the ball and wearing the glass slippers and everything like that, that's the middle of the book, the middle of the story. And then she goes home and the prince has to search through all the whole land and all that jazz. But there, it's the hinge that opens the second part of the story. And after all this, then this is what happened next. So I think in most narratives, there's a naturally occurring point at which the story changes leads and starts to turn toward what will be the conclusion, what will be the climax, and then the conclusion. And it usually occurs by its very nature, by the nature of story and a balance. There's a first part and a second part, even though there may be a number of book one, book two, book three in a tale, there it seems to be right about at the middle that is the turn on a racetrack. And then you're coming into the stretch run, and then you're crossing the finish line.
So the way you're talking about it, it sounds like it's a natural for you that in terms of story. And, you know, I think it's difficult for some readers or some writers to know where that is. But I don't know, is that something that can be taught? Do you teach that? Do you, when you're teaching a graduate class in novel writing, is this something you focus on, or are you focusing more on just the nature of story?
Well, this is part of the nature of story. The structure is part of the nature of the narrative. And yes, I do teach it. And generally, I think of there being, and this is so arbitrary, it's just going to sound weird, but if you take it away and you go to one of your own books or one of the things that you're writing or someone else is writing and you apply it, you'll see that I'm right. In a narrative, in a full-length novel, there are probably 10 or 11 big events. All right. Mm-hmm. And they happen, one follows the next, and they happen as a result of the previous thing that happened, or as a result of the two previous things that happened. And then the next thing happens as a result of the thing that came before, because all stories depend on cause and effect. And the thing that happens next is in part the cumulative result of the thing that came before. And it's by no means a template, and it's by no means a way of doing the same thing with every story. It occurs naturally unless, and this is a big unless, you're trying to include too many events. And one of the ways that new writers learn that what I call kitchen sinking the story, they're throwing in, they think, I'm going to write this one book and maybe I'll never write another thing, so I'm going to put in everything, every single thing, is when there is too much story, then those landmarks in the structure of the story will not be so readily apparent, because it will be going off on this tangent or that tangent. And this applies even if you have a narration that's from the point of view of three characters. There still is a weight and balance and momentum of a story in which it comes to the middle point, and whoever is telling the story makes that turn and starts to head toward the descent from the mountaintop.
Interesting. As you were speaking, I was thinking of how in The Good Son, there's such a nice balance of narrative and scene, so that, you know, your writing is visual and sensory, and it seems like there's just such a nice balance of dialogue. There's a nice balance, you know, it's all working. And at this point, I mean, this is your 13th novel, adult novel. Has that always been one of your strengths, or is that something you learned along the way? Yeah, balancing narrative and scene, you know.
It's something I learned along the way, most definitely, because if, like many writers, you're good at one thing, okay? You're better at one thing than you are at some other thing. And what I tend to be good at is speech, mm-hmm. talking. People talking to each other. And all my books would just be people talking to each other if I hadn't taught myself how to realize that when you confront two solid pages of dialogue, the effect on the reader is of drowning in speech. And so you have to steer clear of that and find a way that you have a scene and then a segue into another scene, a scene which is a little story with a beginning, middle, and an end. And then you have a transition into another, in a pause, a segue, a pause for reflection for the characters and for the reader, and then another scene. And I learned part of that from the only craft writing book that I've ever read in my life, which is actually about writing screenplays. It's called Story by Robert McKee.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And it is just so good in that it teaches writers, particularly new writers, that that things cannot hurdle breakneck from one piece of action to the next piece of action. There has to be a pause for the reader to become ready emotionally for the next thing to happen. Just as you can't have a movie, a film, a horror movie, in which there's just one jump scare after the next jump scare. There has to be a period of suspense and reflection before the next thing happens. And what, having learned that, I learned that mostly actually from reading good books. Reading books that I admired, and and learned how those stories were paced. And once you have been able to internalize the way things feel best to you as a reader, you can make progress with that as a writer.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. And yeah, the book, McGee's book, is such a, I think, a necessary addition to any writer's library, new writer especially. Glad you mentioned that. I would love to hear you read from The Good Son. Would you do that?
You bet. I would love to. This little part here doesn't give away spoilers, because we already know that Belinda was killed, and it doesn't really give anything away. It's a period of reflection. It's very near the end of the book.
Okay.
And it's Thea, the main character, the mother of the boy convicted of the crime, who's coming out of prison. She's speaking about everything that has happened. She's the first person narrator. Right. And so I was changed. I would not have wanted to be changed. Still, I cannot go back to before. We are annealed, but not restored. It was against my will that I learned what Jill had to teach me about love and loss and about myself. Am I better for having learned it? Probably, but only because I have no choice. Now I know that when you lose a child, it's not the same as losing a contemporary, even a beloved husband or wife. When you lose a child, you grieve as a child grieves, which is to say you grieve backward. You don't get better as time passes. You get worse. Time does not take you closer to acceptance, only further from the one that you love. Day by day, Belinda slipped away from Jill. Season by season, the clothes in Belinda's closet were no longer the current style. The music on her player was not the music other kids listened to anymore. Year by year, other people's daughters and sons, once the same age as Belinda, grew up, and they did the things that Belinda might have done. They graduated college and started medical school or graduate school. They joined the Peace Corps. They backpacked across Europe. They found their first jobs. They learned to sign contracts and leases and health insurance forms. Some of them got engaged. The more of those milestones that passed, the more meaningless the world became. Jill did not get stronger. She only got older without Belinda. The very good memories, silly small things, the way Belinda cried when a dog died in a movie, the gleam of sunscreen on her small shoulder at the beach, the color of the Christmas wrapping paper she stamped out by hand, the way Belinda hummed as she made her oatmeal, the way she wrapped her long hair in an old t-shirt to dry, these things began to lose their sharp edges. The sound of a laugh that was like Belinda's, the sudden burst of a song Belinda loved, the smell of freesia, a scrawl of words on an old grocery list in the bottom of a drawer, buy strawberries. All these had to be wrenched out of Jill's mind and compacted like trash until they were no longer familiar or even recognizable. These very good memories scalded Jill like zinc in her eyes, but the pain was much, much better because at least it was feeling. And feeling had washed off her like sidewalk chalk in the rain. The scalding grief was better because it was the dark twin of the stupefying love you felt for your child when you had your child with you. A passion so much bigger than anything you expected to feel, so much bigger than any other parent's love, so magnificent you had to keep it secret, lest the bored gods relent and knock it out of your hands. Jill's love for her only was a second son. And as the sun disappeared, minute by hour, by day, by week, by month, by year, so did her reason.
Thank you so much. That was Jacqueline Michard reading from The Good Son, published by Mira. As you were reading, I was wondering if you read aloud as you're writing or at any point during the process. Do you read your work aloud?
No.
No?
No, I love to read aloud when I'm reading to somebody or when I'm reading a poem that I love to to one of my kids or something like that. But I don't read my work aloud. In fact, I'll tell you the truth. I don't read it silently either.
Really?
Really. I just write it down. And of course, I guess this isn't an of course, but like many writers, I always leave something to be done at the end of a session of writing so that I will have to come back and look at what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
In order to go forward, in order to go on to the next thing. And I'm editing and revising everything as I go along. I don't write it all down and just get shut of it and then go back and, oh my goodness, I cannot imagine going back and starting over at the beginning three or four times the way my friends do. That would make me crazy.
Has it always been that way?
Always.
Interesting.
Everybody has, you know, her own style. Right. And I've been encouraged by many people to just take that leap and set everything down as it comes and sort of get it in the roughest possible shape. But down on paper or down in a document so that you know where you stand. But it doesn't work for me. And again, we were talking earlier when we first started talking, I compare this process sometimes to building a house. And I guess to me, it seems like you wouldn't just get the house thrown up, you know, and then go back and correct it and try to make it stand up straight. Yeah. For me, everything has to be laid down perfectly, or what I consider perfectly, and then on to the next thing, on to the next level.
And then do you do a final polish, or at that point, because of the way you work, is it done?
It's finished by the time I'm finished. But again, that's only finished to me,
right?
Because when my agent reads it, he's not going to be finished. And when the editor reads it, she's going to have a bunch of suggestions for revisions. One tries, of course, to do as few revisions as possible, but they're inevitable.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about the ending without giving any spoilers, because I found it surprising. I found the end of the book surprising, and I love it when it's not predictable and when I'm reading along and I'm surprised, because so often you kind of know what's going to happen, right? You read anyway if you love the writing or you love
whatever.
But with your book, I was totally surprised. And but you knew the ending, you were working toward that because you knew it. And how did you, I don't know, how do you lay down enough, but not too much, so that the reader is surprised?
You know, I try to lay down everything that I can without saying the actual thing, because I want the reader to be able to go back and say, of course, that makes sense. You know, that was right there. It was hiding in plain sight.
Right.
And so that's my goal. I think that this story, despite what one critic had to say about it, who said, oh, you could tell from the first minute. And usually I listen to bad things about my writing with a near religious fervor. But this time I said, nope, you couldn't. You could not tell. Nope, you could not tell that this was that about what had really happened. And you could not tell what Thea's reaction would be either.
No, you really couldn't.
No, I felt confident in that. but I, without giving anything away either, I do not think of it as any less of a tragedy, perhaps even more.
Right. Right. So you read reviews? Do you read, because you just said you listened to what's said about your writing with a religious fervor. Will you read your reviews as well?
Only the bad ones.
Why just the bad ones? That drives most writers crazy, right? That's all you can think about.
Yeah, but I think that they have something to teach me.
Mm-hmm.
And if, unless the person is just wearing like cruel shoes that day, which mm-hmm. I suppose is possible sometimes, and you can tell when reviewers write things, whether they have affection for the writer himself or herself, or, you know, whether they had an affair. I didn't mean that. But you can tell that whether it's personal or whether it isn't,
right?
Sometimes. But I do think that bad reviews have something to teach me. They have something to tell me about the way that I tried to reproduce the tune that I was hearing in my head. And maybe I didn't make the reader hear it in certain places. Whereas, to be honest, most writers, let me put this. Most writers know what they do fairly well. And most writers know when they're being honest. And that amounts to the same thing. Usually, if you're being honest and not trying to dazzle the reader or be cheesy with the reader or manipulate the reader, that comes across as a pretty good piece of writing. What writers don't know is what they're doing wrong.
Yeah, that's a great point. And most writers don't really want to hear the bad stuff though, right? I mean, it's like,
oh, it's horrifying. It's awful. I mean, no, of course not. It's like hearing that you, oh no, it's not like that. It's not like what I was going to say, but it is, it got away from you. Mm-hmm. And you have, by the end of a story, you have done the very best you can. And then I personally am ready to move on. I don't want anything to, I remember an acquaintance of mine, a good acquaintance of mine, Jill McCorkle, you know who she is.
Yeah, of course. She was on the show.
Oh, she was? Okay. Isn't she terrific?
Yeah.
This was her book. I think it was called Niagara Falls All Over Again.
Mm-hmm.
When she was on a program with me at a luncheon, she stood up with the book and held it up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I hate this book." and she didn't mean that she didn't think it was good. And she meant that she was done with it.
Right.
And that is the way that I feel about my stories when it's over. Like right now, I don't hate The Good Son yet because I haven't really firmly established myself in the book that I'm writing now. When I do, I'll feel as though we had a great time together, but this marriage is over. And I'm dating the next door neighbor now. So please don't get in the way.
Can you say a little bit more about being honest in your writing, especially in writing fiction? Like, because students sometimes say, well, what do you mean being honest in fiction? It's fiction.
Well, my great friend, Laurie Moore, who is a short story writer and a novel writer, but mostly a real maestra of the short story, says that the house of fiction is not real, but it has to have all the things that would be in a regular house: plumbing, cornflakes. It has to have a front porch. It has to have a mailbox. It has to be authentic, and the reader has to move into the house of fiction and be able to inhabit it. Mm-hmm. So unless you're writing a fantasy novel, and even then, the most important part of a fantasy novel is the emotional underpinning and reality of it. So that's what I mean by honesty. I mean emotional honesty, in which nothing is tricksy and nothing is truly manipulative. You guide the reader where you want the reader to go emotionally. You provoke the emotions that you want the reader to have, but you have to provoke them with genuine art and not with manipulations that you want the reader to laugh and cry, but not hate themselves for it in the morning. Right?
Yes, right.
So you have to be emotionally honest, and it will show every time. It will, you'll be able to, your own, if you're a reader, and I'm alarmed, I want to say, by the number of writers who say, oh, who has time to read? But that's a whole other podcast. is if you are a reader who has good taste, you'll know when you're in the hands of a writer who is being honest with you. You have to presume that your reader is smart and sophisticated. And what you want the reader to feel as an author, you want the reader to feel as smart as the reader is, but also in on something that is a great secret and a great privilege and only for the reader. Hmm. So you want the reader to feel appreciated and smart and in on it, in on the secret.
Yes.
And if the reader doesn't feel that, the reader is going to feel cheated and not only not like the book, but also hate your guts.
Hmm. Well, early on, when we first started talking, you talked about creating sympathetic characters. And I'm curious about that because, you know, there's quite a lot of characters in fiction right now who are unlikable and interesting. And sometimes sympathetic, sometimes not.
Certainly. In my first novel, Beth Cappadora in the Deep End of the Ocean, mm-hmm. was a character that she was unlikable by any measure. She was depressed. You know, depressed people are not always that much fun. She was vengeful. She refused to give up her obsessions. But if you did not end up liking her, you ended up understanding her and caring what happened to her. And that's a different thing. That's all that's necessary, is for the reader to care what happens to that character enough to trust you on the journey of the book and find that out. I don't expect everyone to love every character that that I set down. For example, even though she is at the center of a tragedy, the character of Jill in The Good Son is not particularly appealing at the beginning. But I want people to believe that her story is worth knowing. And there is a certain amount of, look at one of the books that I found most instructive in my writing life was a book I read when I was, I don't know, in seventh grade for the first time. Mm-hmm. I've read it many times, called In Cold Blood by Cody. Okay. Yeah. And there is such a thing as sympathy for the devil. No one believes that either Richard Hickok or Perry Smith, the murderers, was worthy of the reader caring about them. But the skill with which Truman Capote created those were real people, but created those characters and brought their past and their lives to the reader on the page, you are unable to feel anything less than a certain empathy you know, there, but for the grace of God goes I or one of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the artist's task, really, is to create a character, Jude the Obscure, Tessa the D'Urbervilles, Catherine Earnshaw in Wuthering Heights, who is not necessarily your best pal or someone that you want to hang around with, but is so absorbing that the reader cares.
Yeah, that's great points. Really interesting. I was going to ask you who your influences were, so I'm glad you brought those books up. You've made me want to read In Cold Blood again.
My very favorite book.
Okay.
And the book that I consider most instructive to me was an old book when my mother was a young woman called A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it as one of the most complete and beautiful novels about everything, about life and art and escape and growing up. And it is a book that stands the test of time so beautifully. The language is beautiful, and it inspires me every time I look at it, because it is so deceptively simple, and so is In Cold Blood.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I think, the mark of a really good craftsman, of someone who can really write, is when the prose is understandable to a smart 12-year-old.
Hmm.
But the power of it lies not in the way, well, it lies in the way that things are said, the choices of the words and the choices of the way the information is presented, but also the power of what is being said.
Hmm. You know, I don't think I've ever read A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
It has the most beautiful first sentence.
I'm going to have to read it.
I did an interview the other day in which someone asked me what my favorite first sentence in a book, and that is that's it.
Hmm. Well, we are at the end of our time, and you've covered a lot. A lot has been instructive, I think, for the writers listening in terms of process and so much about The Good Son. I wonder if there's anything else, any tips for the writers working through a novel that you might have.
Be a good reader, silly duckling.
Yeah, be a good reader.
Yes. Always go back to your muses and let them teach you. Humble yourself at the altar of your betters and let them teach you, and don't think that it will muddy up your voice. So many times new writers say to me, oh, I just can't be influenced by other people reading other people's fiction. That's not even true, because, and it's silly, because the old masters, you know, they went, Picasso went to the Louvre to study the paintings of the writers or the painters who came before him and tried to compose things in the way that they did. And the things that you are drawn to as a reader, the things that you admire most, when you read them, they will help you find your own voice.
Mm, yes. Thank you for that. It reminds me of something Billy Collins said when he was on the show, and we were talking about this, you know, reading while you're writing. And he said, that'd be like going to Juilliard and saying, I never listened to music. They'd kick you out. They would just kick you out. And that's so, right. Reading and rereading. It sounds like you reread.
I do. I don't reread everything, but there are an embarrassing number of books on my Kindle that I just can't bring myself to remove from the device. I'm the only person I know has three Kindles. That's just crazy. All with different, it is crazy that all of them have different things on them, because I keep going back and looking at parts of stories that nurture me.
Mm-hmm. That's what a Kindle is really good for too, because you can mark it up and find it pretty
true in a way that you can't necessarily in a hardcover book.
Yeah.
My mentor was a science fiction writer. Okay.
Oh, who was that?
His Ray Bradbury.
Oh, yes, of course. Okay.
And we were friends for 30 years until, you know, he died at a great age. He was 92 when he died.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. he told me that his muses were always with him wherever he went, whether he was riding a bicycle in Ireland or whether he was composing on a typewriter or a laptop. The muses were always looking over his shoulders, and he felt that he could lean on the shoulders of whoever it was, of Shakespeare or other writers who inspired him, and that they would help him to persevere.
Hmm.
So I try to do the same thing. I lean on Ray's shoulders sometimes, and I lean on the shoulders of all of the better writers who have come before me.
Hmm. Yes. I interestingly, I just reread Fahrenheit 451 and found that it held up, and I loved it even more.
Yikes. Harrowing story.
Harrowing and prescient as to what's going on today. In any case, Jacqueline Michard, thank you so much for coming on the show and for writing The Good Son.
Thank you is mine. I really appreciate you asking me, and I'm most happy to be here and to be able to talk to readers and writers.
Yes, thank you. That was Jacqueline Michard, author of The Good Son. The show was produced by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Music and sound editing by Travis Barrett. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. More at penonfire.com. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.